The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to this Society Guardian Mental Health Podcast, a programme that takes an inside look at the issues that matter in the field of mental health. I'm Mary O'Hara. Coming up, we talk to the Mental Health Foundation about their new report into anger and mental illness and ask, are we creating a new disorder?
People should be responsible for their own actions. And to say, oh, extreme anger is not my fault, it's somebody else's fault, I wouldn't agree with that.
Author and columnist Claire Allen, who spent a decade in and out of a psychiatric hospital, tells us about the television adaptation of her award-winning book, Poppy Shakespeare.
So you neurotic, psychotic or what?
Let's get one thing straight, right? I am not a nutter. There is nothing whatever wrong with my head. Got it?
And we'll be hearing from Bosse Danya about her experiences of living with depression.
For me, when I had the breakdown, I was so depressed. I really was. I was at the lowest, and I couldn't imagine myself getting to where I am now, let alone have a baby.
Before we get going, let me introduce the people I've got here with me in the studio. As well as Claire Allen, we have Andrew McCulloch, Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation, and Paul Keedwell, Honorary Consultant Psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital in London, and author of the book How Sadness Survived. So, anger and mental health. Are we living in an angrier society? The Mental Health Foundation say we are. Their latest report, Boiling Point, published to coincide with this year's Mental Health Action Week, found that almost two-thirds of us believe people are getting angrier. But is the problem really as big as the report suggests? And if so, what should be done about it? We have been out on the streets asking people what they think.
Anger is a human physical emotion that everyone experiences. It's definitely not something that should be classed as mental health. That's something completely on its own. It's something separate.
I think it would do, actually, because that's usually when people get out of control, isn't it? So, yeah, it would be a bit of a mental illness.
I think emotional expression is actually part of human nature. Yes, you need to be able to master your emotions, but to classify as a mental illness, I think, is not helpful.
People should be responsible for their own actions. And to say, oh, extreme anger is not my fault, it's somebody else's fault, I wouldn't agree with that.
I don't think it's a mental illness, but you can actually help people to kind of guide them and understand it and manage it better. I think that's the best option.
So there we have it, the views from the street. Now we get the views from our panellists. First, Andrew, there are any number of serious mental health issues. Why choose anger for Mental Health Action Week?
It's because we believe that it's something the public are worried about, and we also believe that we're not intervening with very serious problem anger until people get into the criminal justice system, and that seems to me to be wrong. I actually agree with a lot of what we've just heard, especially the last lady who actually summed up the report very well. We're not looking for anger to be classified as a mental illness. That's not why we're called the Mental Health Foundation. We're interested in people having good mental health, and the expression of anger in a healthy way can be part of that. But we actually need to help people whose anger is damaging their lives and damaging their families' lives. It's no good just blaming them. Of course, they may have done something bad and they may need to be punished, but actually the punishment alone is not necessarily going to change that person's life or reduce the harm to society.
The research does say that at least there's a perception of people getting angrier in general. If that's the case and we're trying to deal with it, are we at risk of pathologising the issue, Paul, if we look at that?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at is a clear distinction between anger, which is a basic emotion that we all feel and it's healthy to express it in an appropriate way, and problem anger, where your anger can lead to aggressive behaviour. So again, there's a distinction there as well between the emotion and the behaviour, which can lead people to harm themselves or others, either physically, emotionally or otherwise, and could lead to them ending up in the criminal justice system. It is a shame, I think, that psychiatry doesn't... I think a lot of psychiatry chimes in with the opinion of the person who said, you are responsible for your own problem anger. We're not regarding it as a clinical issue. And probably anger ends up in the mental health system at the moment as a byproduct of something else like depression or schizophrenia. Or
so it's misunderstood, else. Essentially, is it?
Yeah, I think we need more talking therapies to be available for anger management at the moment. There is precious little out there for people who actually present saying, I have a problem with anger, I need some help with this.
Claire, from a service user perspective, what's your take on this? Is it an issue that is misunderstood in the mental health sector as well as wider society?
Sure. I mean, there are a number of things that come to mind listening to both of you talk. And I mean, one sort of obvious thing is the way in which the language of anger and the language of mental ill health cross over. People all the time say, you know, it drove me mad, it drove me crazy, and they mean it made me angry. And I think that's not for no reason. And the other thing, which Paul, you know, drew on is this link between, you know, that anger is not necessarily a negative thing at all. I mean, quite the opposite. And perhaps it's when somebody's angry and they also feel impotent that anger has to go somewhere. And very often it goes either in the mental health system, very often inwards, and in the criminal justice system, sometimes outwards, or, you know, as a generalization. So I think it's very important to think about why people are angry. And sometimes, you know, from a user's point of view, sometimes there are very good reasons to be angry.
Andrew, that's an important point,
isn't
it?
I think that's absolutely the case, and this report doesn't deal with it because in any depth, because it's actually just trying to put anger on the agenda. But I think the fundamental roots of anger are often issues like social injustice, poverty, the way people have been parented, alcohol, etc., some of which are people's personal responsibility. Of course, we don't deny that. I think it's very healthy for people to take responsibility for their own actions, but it's got to be recognised what the context of that is. And these are the same root causes of a lot of mental illness as well. And this is where that there is a closeness that I agree with Claire, that's actually quite profound and quite important. You can't get that across in just one report, though.
The report does highlight, though, doesn't it, that GPs, who are always the front line of medicine, whether mental health or physical health, they are sometimes frustrated, aren't they?
GPs actually agreed with us because they do get patients presenting with problem anger, either directly or as part of another condition, alcoholism or whatever it might be, and they do want to offer an intervention. You know, a lot of us have been knocking GPs too much. They only have a few minutes. They have the prescription pad. They don't always have the alternatives like talking therapy or anger management courses. And they'd really, really like to have those alternatives and to be able to refer patients. By patients, we're just talking about people that have come into the GP surgery.
Yes, there's a gap because, you know, to a certain extent, therapy might have been available in the psychiatric sector, but now the focus is very much on secondary care, focusing on the severely mentally ill. So now there's a gap, and that's what the government's trying to fill, obviously.
Would it help clinicians if anger wasn't misdiagnosed as something else? If people have a real problem with it and it's a root cause of another condition, say?
Yeah, I mean, when we, you know, a clinician looks at people presenting with complaints. They don't, people don't come to you complaining of a disorder. So someone comes to you saying, I've got problems with my anger, then that's fine. We should be able to deal with that. I think the difficulty is that both psychiatrists and GPs can feel impotent about referring on, because a lot of the time the job of the psychiatrist is to assess and refer for appropriate treatment. They may not have time to get involved with the necessary therapy themselves, and and especially if it's someone presenting it to, I mean, when I was on call, people would present in the middle of the night to accident and emergency departments.
Because that brings up a very important point, doesn't it, in terms of what's currently available. If you are, say, for instance, Claire, a service user, and you are concerned and you want help, is there a limit on what help we can get, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably, there will always be a limit. That's just realistic. I think, yes, that there's a great variety of treatment according to sort of where you live and how lucky you are. There's also an enormous variety of quality of that treatment. And I do think that perhaps another thing, I'm just sort of thinking about things that make me angry, you know, in the system. And one of those, it is a sense of not being heard, you know, not being in any way in control of, you know, often I might have an idea what I need, but I seem nobody seems to be listening to that.
That's a feeling shared by a lot of people in the
Absolutely.
System.
And I think sort of more service user-led services and that sort of thing, it could be very helpful in that respect.
Yeah, and that's part of the national service framework. You know, it just we want to see that happening, really, and users getting more involved. I think it's actually more satisfying for psychiatrists as well when they're meeting the patient's needs and not sort of having to subscribe to some sort of medical model.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding.
Can't do that with anger. Yeah.
Finally, Andrew, sorry I have to cut it short here, but what is the one clear message that you would like to come out of this report and out of Mental Health Action Week?
I think the one clear message is that anger's very important. It's both good and bad. But when it gets to be a problem, we should offer some help with that problem before it becomes so serious that, in the worst case scenario, someone gets killed, actually. But often families break down, jobs are lost, alcohol consumption goes up, etc.
So very serious society.
Early intervention. Let's get in there and offer somebody something that's going to help move them on, something that's evidence-based, practical, local, meets their needs, instead of just waiting till it gets worse and worse.
I'd like to thank all the panellists today, Paul Keedwell, Andrew McCulloch and Claire Allen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Claire Allen's writing, witty, sometimes shocking, always illuminating, has opened up the world of mental health service users to new audiences. Her powerful debut novel, Poppy Shakespeare, drawn on her own experience, is a satirical depiction of the lives of mental health service users in a North London mental health unit. The book was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award and longlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction. It's been hailed as the most revealing look at madness since One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Reviewers have called it terrifyingly real, sharp and perceptive, and laugh-out-loud funny. Now the story comes to television with Channel 4's adaptation starring Naomi Harris as Poppy and Anna Maxwell Martin as her mentor, N. Here's a quick preview.
Hey. Who did you say you was?
Supposed to tell you around and everything, be your guide. Tony asked me special, so it'd do me good.
Oh, I thought you were staff.
Like a nurse? Thought I was a nurse.
Sorry.
Oh, dear.
Hey, listen. That thing I said about, you know, not being a nutter. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't realise. I haven't got a problem with mental illness. It's just there's nothing the matter with me.
Don't worry about that. They must think you're mad. They won't be here.
Claire, as with the book, this programme is powerful and it's disturbing and it's funny. Is it a true reflection of your experiences and of the book as you saw it?
I think it very much depends what you mean by true. I mean, the book, neither the book nor the film is in any way attempting to be a sort of literal account of that world. But I think there are different sorts of truth. And I do think that fiction can tell a very powerful emotional truth through use of satire and exaggeration and so on. I mean, the book is told through the narrator, Anne, entirely in her voice. And you soon sort of realise, perhaps, you know, within a page, that she's not wholly to be trusted. But that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of truth in what she's saying, even if it's in the hyperbole. Yes, I mean, I feel that I was trying to capture a sort of feeling, just an essence of that world as I experienced it. Obviously, I can't speak for anybody else. It's very personal and it's very subjective. Whether the film is sort of like the book, it's just so hard to say. I mean, so much of a book is what the reader brings to it. You know, that's something I've really discovered. I always thought when I read something that was the definitive reading, but not the case at all. So the film is an interpretation of the book, and I think it's a very interesting interpretation, a very powerful one.
But there are very definite issues that come out of this, aren't there? There are issues like staff indifference or staff who are pushed and pulled in different directions. There's service user rights, patients talking about the changes in the system, how it affects them. There's the issue of accessibility to doctors and about doctors' assessments. So you deal with the inner politics, if you like, of that world. I think we've got an extract just on assessments and how that impacts.
How often do you lot see the doctors?
Once a year for our annual assessment.
Yeah, and what about other stuff in between?
We don't normally see them in between, unless it's to change medication.
Yeah, but I'm not on medication.
Then you don't need to see them, do you?
Well, how do they know you're getting better if they never see you? I mean, how can they tell?
We're all formally assessed every year for the doctors to evaluate our progress. Medication, treatment and level of care is determined accordingly.
Tell her about the mirrors.
We don't know that.
Well, we're pretty certain.
Claire, for people who don't know anything about what it's like inside a mental health unit, these are very vivid, very rich, textured pictures of life inside them. And those issues seem very, very important to people. Was that absolutely crucial to you to get that across?
Yes, I think what listening to that clip, what sort of comes over to me is the sense of disempowerment, really, that those patients have, the lack of control over their lives. And in some ways, that's in their head. I mean, they are voluntary patients, but it isn't because they actually don't believe they can exist anywhere else. So seeing a doctor is massively important to them and massively frightening. They may be sort of thrown out of the hospital and they honestly believe, having become very dependent, they couldn't survive in that way. Now, obviously, as I say, it is a satire, it is exaggerated. I'm not suggesting you actually see a doctor once a year. But I think there is some truth to it in my experience, which is I sort of imagined that doctors would be, you know, quite omnipresent in hospitals. And really, I mean, I've stayed in hospital for several months and seen a doctor about three times during that. Mm. When I was a patient at a day hospital, I never saw the consultant on my own. Only ever, sort of every few months, there would be a meeting held. And there might be 20 people in that meeting, many of whom I'd never have met before, students and whoever. And they'd hold a meeting about you, and then you'd get called in for a few minutes so that they could ask you questions, and then you'd be sent out and they'd finish discussing you. Now, that's a very, very disempowering way to... And it may be that, you know, if you're feeling very ill, actually you want somebody else to take control of the situation, but it certainly makes it very difficult to move out of that world into adult society.
I mean, I think that's wonderfully depicted. But one of the things that runs parallel with that, it seems, is a commentary on the wider mental health system, is a commentary on the lives that exist within it for both staff and patients. Was that intentional?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that again, I mean, I can't really talk about the system as a whole. This is written from, you know, I'm not some sort of mental health expert or anything like that. I'm just someone who had this experience and created a novel from it. But yes, there is a feeling of sort of enormous waste, really, of just sort of wasted potential. People not being properly valued. People also just boredom. You know, I mean, in the novel and in the film, you know, patients just sit for... I mean, I sat for months on end in a horrible room with a dead plant in the corner, drinking tea and smoking. That really was it.
It comes across and it yeah. seems quite distressing, but one of the other things that comes across with that is the humour that evolves out of it. I mean, there are terms in there like dribblers for the patients, like mad money, how you get your benefits, and there are all those wonderful little curiosities in a way, but it's a human response to a difficult situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's very much how people very often use humour. I think, you know, comedy and tragedy are two sides of the same coin. They're absolutely not mutually exclusive. And I find it that very often, actually, with sort of memoirs and novels and so on that I've read about set in the psychiatric system, that humour can be rather left out. It's sort of the sort of misery memoir feel. And I think that's a great shame, because actually the comedy is always in the centre of it, and it doesn't make the tragedy less. In many ways, I think the two enhance each other.
Who do you want to watch this programme?
Everyone, you know. as many people as possible. Obviously, people who've read the book, I'd be interested in seeing, you know, they compare the film. But obviously, lots of people who've never read the book or heard of the book, I hope will watch the programme. And it'll just make them think about things. Perhaps think also about one of the things I wanted to challenge was this dividing line between what's normal and what's not, what's sane and what's ill. To me, there doesn't seem to be one. And I think it's just a sort of an invention that we have, which actually does quite a lot of harm. So that's very much what the book and the film are sort of challenging, I think.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Oh, thank you.
Poppy Shakespeare will be broadcast on Channel 4 on Monday the 31st of March at 9 p.m. Now, there are many approaches to dealing with depression. For Bosse Danya, writing poetry was her way of working through difficult times. She's told us about the difference it made to her.
I'm Bosse Danya. I'm my son Samuel, and he is 4 months and 10 days. I hated my childhood. There was good elements, my brothers and sisters, but I didn't have a very good or happy childhood. And so poetry, in one sense, became my escape. But I didn't realise it was poetry, because from what I learned in school about poetry is that poetry has to rhyme and blah, blah, blah. So I never thought it was poetry. I just thought it was just my mental release, really. Feel like I'm emerging from darkness, from a time when demons controlled my mind with their different shapes and images. I found myself praying for death as my only release. For me, it was, I thought, okay, this is my situation. And, you know, being honest with yourself, okay, this is the situation, this is how it is. So it's a matter of, like, how am I going to move forward from it? How am I going to progress? How am I going to get myself back together? But it's that belief that I know that I've got something to offer. I know that I've got ideas. I've got, you know, there's just life in me. And it's like, I just thought to myself, I've accomplished too much in my life to let myself stay at this stage. Feel like I'm emerging from a time when hope was a word that didn't exist and the future was only a day at a time. Feel like I'm emerging from a shell that stood broken into pieces unrecognizable of its former being. I always see the positive. If I'm having a bad day, I'm not going to fight it. It's a bad day. So I'll stay in bed and watch afternoon movies and the old-time movies and stuff like that. Or I watch chat shows of people that got a lot worse than me, and then it makes me feel, well, why am I feeling bad? Feel like I'm emerging, like a newborn baby, learning how to walk the walk of life, learning who I am to become, who I am to be. Feel like I'm emerging to a new dawn, a new awakening. You can get through it. I am through it. So if I can get through it, and then anybody can get through it. But I write it, when I write it, I remember how I felt when I was in it, you know, and I try to guide people towards bringing themselves out of it. But like, it's down to self. You've got to want to bring yourself out of it. Feel like I'm emerging, like a child growing with every day. With society as my guidance, I feel my inner strength. I feel like I'm emerging.
Claire, you talk about using writing to express a kind of truth. Is that what comes across in Bosse's work, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed that. And I think what most strikes me is how much that's an expression of her as an individual, and how much that's not a stereotype. And so often, I think, portrayals of people who've been through mental health problems are seen sort of from the outside, and you don't actually meet them as individuals and as people. And that has a great deal to do with breaking down stigma, if you can just meet somebody in the brilliant way that she shows us there in her poetry.
Great. Thank you very much, Claire. Thanks to all our guests for joining me today. Andrew McCulloch, Paul Keatwell, and Claire Allen. If you'd like to have your say on the issues discussed in this podcast, go to our blog at guardian.co.uk/society, where the debate continues. This has been a Guardian Sound Delivery co-production.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.